This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Alan Scott. Government actions meeting business decisions online at www.bgov.com. That's bgov.com. And on the air here Thursdays at 11, Fridays at 2:30, right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's an election year, and just like in every other election year, candidates are out there with their hands open, vying for money. From constituents, supporters, people open their pockets readily. But according to BGov legislative analyst Melissa Avstring, corporate money only plays a minor role in the 2012 primaries. We'll find out why and understand where that money's coming from with BGov data analyst Peter Brusso. But we'll begin the program today with the so-called elephant in the room, talking about sequestration. Defense sequestration specifically is threatening the livelihood of contractors worldwide. To address the uncertainty, we're joined by BGov defense analysts Dr. Kevin Brancato and Rob Levinson, authors of the BGov study, Sequestration Planning, Scenarios and Options for Defense Contractors. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me.
Great to be here, Alan.
Great.
So we've been down this road before. We've had you guys on the show, and now you've written what I like to consider like an Audubon field guide for those who may be impacted by sequestration as it does come down the pike. For the most part, Congress and the President are on the same page, kind of wanting those cuts undone for the most part. But the bills reversing the reduction has yet to be passed. Rob, I turn to you. What's the holdup? Can this be avoided?
Well, you know, you say they're on the same page, and that's true in sort of the broad sense, Alan.
Everybody's on the same.
Nobody thinks sequestration is a good idea. It was designed to be basically so horrible that it would force them to come up with another solution.
Right.
The problem gets into the details of the solution. I mean, basically the impasse is, you know, the president would like to see tax increases be part of a solution to sort of avoid these cuts. And for the most part, the Republicans have said that that can't be part of the picture. Now, in recent weeks, there have been perhaps a little glimmer of light there that maybe some Republicans, Lindsey Graham and a few others, are talking about maybe putting some revenue on the table. So there may be the beginnings of something. But really, nobody's expecting that any sort of deal is going to get cut before the elections in November. And then after that, when both parties see who's going to be in the White House and who's going to be in control of both houses, then perhaps a deal might get cut. But they've got a lot on their plate in November besides sequestration, debt ceiling, tax,
right,
Bush tax cuts, things like that.
You kind of hit on something there. Mentioned that the Republicans, Democrats, almost a divide. Leon Panetta said, the nation's problems are held hostage to the unwillingness to find consensus and compromise. Kevin, what are your thoughts?
Well, it's going to be very clear that the Secretary of Defense is going to defend spending on defense.
That's kind of an unspoken rule.
It's unspoken rule. But you see consistency amongst every single member of the military, the armed forces, representatives of the Office of Management and Budget. And you see the same thing on the House and Senate Armed Services Committee. They don't want the cuts, but they're not providing any viable known alternative to the cuts. The House members have said, yes, we have provided an alternative, we've passed an alternative, but not really. There's no consensus on how to achieve this. And when they say the president is willing, the president wants revenue enhancements, wants tax increases, the House members are willing to cut entitlements. But you have to remember where this all comes from. This Budget Control Act of 2011 comes from an impasse, mm-hmm, where the House Republicans did not want to raise the spending limit and the debt ceiling for the federal government. We come down once again to the same problem where this $55 billion in defense cuts is sitting right there, and there's no alternative how to pay for that $55 billion, whether entitlement cuts, tax increases. Somebody, somewhere has to get hit. It's either going to be defense contractors, or it's going to be those receiving entitlements, or it's going to be everyone through tax increases. And that's not the way that policymakers want to frame this, but that's the reality of the situation.
Understood. So Defense Secretary Leon Panetta went on to say at a speech just a couple of weeks ago at the Pentagon, talking about things that he has done since he has taken office, things that he's accomplished, responsible for troop reductions in Afghanistan, the NATO mission in Libya, along with the fall of Gaddafi, talking about Al-Qaeda, pay and benefits for military increased and jobs jobs for family members. Don't ask, don't tell. All the things that he's hugely proud of. And you know, Kevin, you pointed it out properly. He's the defense secretary, the man who's going to be behind all this. Not a fan of sequestration, obviously. So if this does get rolled out, Rob, give me some of the nuts and bolts. Let's lay this out here so people understand the path that this will take.
Well, basically, Alan, as we've talked about before, as Kevin mentioned, it's $55 billion. Now, where that comes out of, you got to do a little bit of math, because basically the president has the ability to take the personnel accounts, which is about $135 billion, sort of off the table, and it's not subject to sequestration. So he can pull that out. There's about another $14 billion in the war spending that's personnel, and he can take that off the table.
Mm-hmm.
And then it appears that it is the case that any money that's already obligated, in other words, put on contract, is also off the table. So if you assume about 25% of the budget through the beginning of the fiscal year, which starts in October before January when sequestration takes effect, that's another $122 billion or so that gets taken off the table. But then there's some leftover money from previous years that is on the table. So there's this whole big mix of
big
money.
Matrix
of money. When Kevin and our best calculation is that what of the money that's left over, it's about 12.2%. If you're just talking about 2013 money using the president's budget, which hasn't been passed, but it's a 2013 proposal, it's about 9.2% of that money. But the real trick is, as we've talked about, the implementation, and maybe I'll let Kevin talk about, you know, where the specific cuts sort of come from.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, and this is the problem for all the defense contractors, is neither the Pentagon nor their Office of Management and Budget or anyone else has said precisely where these cuts would come from.
Exactly. What programs are going to be impacted? No one knows yet.
Which programs? And the president has said he will exempt military personnel. He has not done so. There is no call for it. The sequestration would be implemented on January 2nd, 2013. The first tranche, that first $55 billion, of course, it would be the budget levels would be cut $55 billion many years thereafter as well. And there are caps to spending. Defense contractors simply have no idea whether or not there will be a roughly 9% cut to their budget in 13, whether their programs would be exempt entirely. Because, as we have seen in the law, there are many possibilities for the Pentagon, the president, or Congress to try to provide an alternative within sequestration. So if there are $55 billion in cuts, it does not have to be across the board. It could be targeted, but that would require quite a substantial review. And the Pentagon has said that they have not even started on this planning process. It looks like it would be large enough that they may have to reorder some of their strategy. And from then on, look to see which systems would support that strategy. That's a very intensive process. And it's very difficult to believe they haven't really thought through this process.
I was just about to say, this is an intense process that is around the corner. One would think that they've already begun some thoughts around this, or discussions at the very least.
They've already started their planning process for their 2014 budget. That's currently in review right now. The 2013 budget has not been passed. The president proposed it in February. Congress has not passed that. They may very well not, and there would be a continuing resolution, a spending bill that spends it previous year's money. Mm-hmm. But the Pentagon right now has to review its current plans and processes, and it's not clear whether or not they have alternatives that says a high-low alternative if sequestration is implemented in 2014, in 2013 and 14, versus if it's, say, not implemented at all versus implemented or delayed in 2013 and implemented in 14. It's completely unclear. So when defense companies say, well, we don't know, we have this huge amount of uncertainty, we might have to offer peremptory pink slips, it gets a little bit of credibility because
right.
There's a tremendous level of uncertainty driven by the lack of a credible decision from Congress and the president. There's no consensus, and that I think you'll find out in the coming months that this really has driven defense executives crazy.
Right. You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're speaking with Dr. Kevin Brancato and Robert Levinson. Both are defense analysts with Bloomberg Government and authors of the latest study, Sequestration Planning, Scenarios and Options for Defense Contractors. Now, we're talking about the ways that a contractor could zig or zag dependent on what happens with regard to sequestration. No one is really making those announcements. I want to bring one of those contractors into the conversation here. His name is Mick Weiser. He is president of Columbia Technology Partners, a firm out in Columbia, Maryland, oddly enough. And he is one of those defense contractors who could be impacted by this. Mick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Mick, as you're hearing the discussions here, is it scaring you at all? What are you thinking? What are your thoughts? Or are you planning at this point?
In fact, we are planning. Simply put, this is going to have a tremendous impact on our planning purposes for the next several years. The immediate impact this year in 2013 is going to be absolutely ugly.
Well, now you say ugly. Let's can you give us some numbers, or are you actually just sitting back going, looking, speculating as you're viewing the business development plan for 2013? Is it dismal?
To say the least, we expected, quite frankly, with the drawdown in Iraq and Afghanistan, that there would be cuts. But with this requirement for cutting down another $55 billion beyond, the percentages go up dramatically. And the key factor is that with there's no prioritization with it, we exactly don't know where it's going to be. We have to anticipate it's going to be across the board and prepare accordingly.
Mick, this is Rob. Let me ask you a question. Now, you... In many cases, you're probably a subcontractor to some of the big prime contractors, people like, say, Lockheed Martin or Boeing or
absolutely,
Northrop
yes.
Grumman. And so, in some ways, aren't you kind of dependent not so much on the government action, but then how the big primes respond? In other words, you're supplying Lockheed, who's supplying the government, or you're supplying Boeing, who's supplying the government. So don't you kind of have to wait to see what the prime does and how that kind of impacts you?
It's a combination of things. Yes, in fact, we do work for the primes and in turn support the customer via those mechanisms. But a lot of times we try to prepare ourselves independently. Simply put, we as a small company try to make sure we diversify our customers, our contracts, and so on. So when the impact comes in, we make sure that we're on critical requirements so that the likelihood of being cut, it won't happen. That's our expectation. The other thing that we also do is make sure we have quality people. So both the primes and government customer want to retain our services and our people as they try to execute their missions.
Regardless of what the future holds, they
absolutely.
Consider you a partner now. You're walking lockstep, so they can't do their job without you.
Exactly.
In meetings that you're having while fostering, like, maybe teaming partners or business development, is there any sense out in the community that that sequestration is going to be as dismal as you may describe it for 2013?
Folks are very nervous. People are watching this very closely. People are actually starting to slow down a tad bit as far as hiring and that kind of thing. And people will be much more deliberate about their actions.
Which date scares you more, October 1st or January 3rd?
January 3rd.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
See,
this is Kevin, Mick.
Yeah.
When we've looked at it, we've seen that there's this cutoff date of January 2nd, January 3rd. But the Office of Management and Budget can't wait. It can't wait for sequestration, because if the funding's going to hit, they're going to have to pull back early. Because sequestration is law. It's already written there that this will happen. And it's not clear whether or not they would be permitted to spend that money that would be sequestered. So it looks to us like it would, being at the beginning of the fiscal year, that they'd have to start holding back.
Right. I understand what you're saying there. My one concern is the fact that a lot of smart people looked at this kind of thing, and I would anticipate that for the first quarter, the people are going to be very aggressive about executing and obligating funds. So that will carry us to their first quarter. I understand what you're saying as far as the OMB pulling back. But simply put, the requirement is January 2nd, and also with the elections coming up, I expect there's going to be some posturing there as well.
Yeah, we've seen that there would be, I think as Rob has said, a tension between the big Pentagon and little Pentagon, is that the Pentagon, big Pentagon would want to hold back, as Rob has said, and maintain its flexibility. But the little Pentagon, all the agencies, have an incentive to get as much as possible on contract.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and of course the contractors have as much incentive, because as we said before, if you're on contract, even if it's 2013 money, if it's on contract, it's sort of off the table for sequestration. But now we have to qualify that a little bit and say, you know, the government could still break a contract. In other words, it could sign a contract prior to sequestration, then January 2nd comes along, sequestration, government thought is, oh my God, we contracted for some money here, but we really need that money over here to protect a bigger priority, so we're going to break this contract. And that's still certainly a possibility. Now, there's always a cost for the government to break the contract is they have to reimburse the contractor for any costs that the contractor's already observed. But it's definitely a possibility of breaking those contracts after sequestration, though. So getting on contract sort of protects you, but it's not 100%.
Absolutely. And the simple truth of the matter is a lot of what you're describing is pretty much current operations anyway. The government will do the best for the government as it is anyway, at that prerogative. The biggest thing is the fact that the depth of the cuts are much more dramatic at this point, and that's the biggest unknown.
Mick Weiser, thank you very much for joining us. Mick is the president of Columbia Technology Partners, a small management and IT consulting firm that provides support to the DOD. He's got lots of experience in this space, and you can reach him at ctp-web.com if you have any questions. The study is called Sequestration Planning Scenarios and Options for Defense Contractors. Kevin, I turn to you. Any last words?
I think the unfortunate aspect here is that contractors have very little option. What they can do is essentially hold on to whatever flexibility they have, get as much as they can on contract, and keep in contact with the program managers and contracting officers and see where their interests align. And that's probably their best bet.
Rob?
Just the parting thought, as you hear from Mick, you know, there's a lot of people in Washington on the political side who said, oh, these cuts are so horrible, they're never going to happen. Congress and the president are going to figure a way out of it. The contractors live in the real world, and they have to deal with the fact that the worst-case scenario, and you can hear from Mick's voice, he's having to plan for, hey, I can't depend on Congress and the president to solve this problem. I got to deal with it as it comes. And, you know, that's a very different perspective from some of the political folks that you hear that think, at the end of the day, things will get solved.
Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, said recently at Offutt Air Force Base out in Nebraska, and I quote, "The question we will answer with your help is how much smaller will that budget become and still allow us to preserve the resources necessary to live up to the responsibility we have." I think that pretty much sums it up.
Absolutely.
You're listening to BleeGov's Capital Impact right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Corporations have deep pockets, especially when it comes to getting what they want. This election year, however, they may not be making those donations to primary campaigns as one originally thought would happen. Melissa Avstray is a legislative analyst with BGov, whose latest study, Corporate Money Has Minor Role in 2012, is now available on BGov, and she's actually here to discuss it. Hello, Melissa.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming in. So back in 2010, the Supreme Court overturned that ban on corporations donating money to campaigns. I mean, why wouldn't they? Corporations could buy a nice president, could buy a nice whatever. That, according to a lot of comments that I found after the overturning. I mean, listen to this. And I will tell you, both Republicans and Democrats aside were making these comments. The Supreme Court, in essence, has ruled that corporations can buy elections. If that happens, democracy in America is over. A lot of harsh words for something that didn't really materialize. Now, did it?
Not quite. Not quite.
Not quite. So before we dive into what really happened, what is it that a corporation can and cannot do with regard to campaign financing?
Sure. So corporations are still banned from donating to candidates, but they are allowed to make independent expenditures or donate to independent expenditure-only committees, which we've come to call super PACs.
Okay.
And so the key thing to remember about super PACs is they can only make independent expenditures, as in an advertisement that is not coordinated with the candidate's campaign, so made independent from the candidate. And these ads could be for or against the candidate, but again, not made in cooperation with that candidate. So there is no corporate money going to candidates themselves.
All right. Your study itself is a little counterintuitive, as I just mentioned a minute ago. Citizens versus federal elections after the overturn back in 2010. Everybody thought, as I kind of mentioned, one of the, here, let me read you another comment here, because some of these are interesting, especially since it didn't come to fruition. Today is a dark day for democracy and a dark day for average citizens. That's pretty harsh.
Yes.
So why didn't this happen? Why didn't it turn out the way they anticipated?
Well, you're right. Super PACs aren't being utilized by corporations as many had predicted.
Right.
I'm sure companies have different reasons for not donating to a super PAC. But one reason most likely is consumer backlash. So most Americans don't shop at a particular store or buy a particular product because mm-hmm. of their partisan leanings. So if a company who was trying to appeal to a wide section of the American public, donates to one super PAC, mm-hmm. they really run the risk of alienating a potential consumer base.
Makes sense. Makes sense. I buy product X and the company endorsed product Y, and now I've alienated 50% of the potential population.
Sure.
The pool of voters. Sure. So when we're looking at this space, who are some of the big players, let's say, in that corporate financing world?
Restore Our Future, the PAC that is supportive of Mitt Romney, received a fair amount of contributions from corporations. But mm-hmm. keep in mind that these contributions that the corporations made paled in comparison to the contributions that individuals made.
So, aha, there's the question. Who is making these contributions? How's that?
So, individuals primarily.
Okay.
The benefit of super PACs to individuals, mm-hmm. particularly wealthy individuals, is that they can donate an unlimited amount of funds. So, for example, if I wanted to donate to a candidate, the most I personally can give that candidate is $2,500 per election. Mm-hmm. So it would be $5,000 total if I gave to the candidate in the primary and another $2,500 in the general. But if there was a super PAC that supports that same candidate, I can give an unlimited amount of funds, say $10 million, if I chose.
Okay. If I had $10 million
yes.
to. But I don't have $10 million to give, so it's not going to make sense in my world. Those dollars aren't going to work. So let's bring somebody else into the conversation. His name is Peter Brusso. Peter, how are you?
Thanks. Good, Alan. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. He's a member of our BGov data team, and let's see if you can help us figure out. Again, this is counterintuitive. We're thinking that the corporations were going to be giving more money than they actually did. Peter, did super PACs play a large role in the primaries?
No, Alan, surprisingly not. Super PACs are not that involved. I think part of that has to do with their fundamental nature. So when you look at who were the candidates who had a tremendous amount of super PAC money, mm-hmm. you had Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich, and they both had these wonderful super PACs. One was called Restore Our Future. Mm-hmm. The other was Winning Our Future. So whatever you're doing with our future, their super PACs are involved with that. The biggest problem that they have is super PACs can't help candidates with what they really need to be doing, and that's paying for candidate travel, having a good ground game mm-hmm. in the early states. And that was the biggest problem in the Republican primary.
Things that some candidates have actually gotten tripped up on in the past.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You wound up having Gingrich spent less money on salary for his campaign staff than very small candidates like John Huntsman or Herman Cain spent. And so when you're not spending that money on your staff, you just don't have an effective ground game. You don't win the nomination.
Okay, so Melissa touched on some ads that you can purchase if you're a super PAC. What kind of ads are we talking about?
Oh, wonderfully negative ads. They are absolutely delightful. And in particular in South Carolina, the Gingrich super PAC, Winning Our Future, ran this 30-minute advert called When Mitt Romney Came to Town and just totally criticized Governor Romney at the time. And what's happening is we're seeing this evolution of negative advertising. Before BCRA, the McCain-Feingold Campaign Finance Act, candidates ran negative ads all the time. Once they had to start taking credit for these ads, mm-hmm. they started to stop running the negative ads, and the party ran the negative ads. Now that you have the super PACs, which have these wonderfully vague names, there's no reason whatsoever for either the Republican or Democratic Party to take credit for a negative ad. So it's basically allowed unlimited negative ads now.
So when you see those negative ads on television or hear them on the radio and they're not credited to anyone in particular, guess who ran them?
That's a very good bet.
His name is Peter Brusso. Her name is Melissa Abstray. The study is available now. Corporate Money Has Minor Role in 2012. Get it on BGov.com. Kevin Brancato and Rob Levinson. Their study available as well. Sequestration planning scenarios and options for defense contractors. Mick Weiser, thanks for joining us from Columbia Technology Partners. Follow us on Twitter at BloombergGov or follow me at Alan L. Scott. We'll meet again next week, Thursday at 11. Lots more to say about the business implications of government actions. For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.